Recording in Los Gatos on April 25th, 2016, this is Geek Speak, episode 17 of our 16th season. And I'm Lyle, and with me is Mr. Miles. Hey, Miles.
Hey.
Actually, Mr. Elam. And I'm just letting you know, podcast listener, the show, of course, for years has been primarily a radio show and not a podcast. And for years, we've been taking the radio show and putting it in our podcast feed. And last year, at some point, we switched away from NPR covering our podcast, and we're actually hosting it ourselves now. We actually lose money all the time on the show. We take no advertising and no money. Any money that comes in goes to the station, the radio station, KOSP, which is where the show started. KOSP is in financial dire straits, and you probably wouldn't know that if you're just a podcast listener, if you're listening this way, because we don't talk a lot about it on the show, or at least the podcast version of the show. But I wanted to do a shout-out that the station is in a situation where if they don't get enough money, I think it's $300,000 total by May 1st, they will sell the license, most likely, and close the doors.
Yep.
Yeah. It's a sad thing. I actually got involved in the station because my father used to run it, so I'm pretty attached to the radio station. Though I have to say, I haven't listened to a lot of it in the last few years. Have you listened to a lot of KOSP?
I do listen to it, yeah.
I've been enjoying the music mm-hmm. in the morning.
Yeah.
And so when I drive my kids to school, since they started to switch to the music format, I started switching on the music station. And I like it as a music station. I enjoy it. I've been telling the people that I know at the station that run the shows that I'm digging it. Mm-hmm. But it hasn't been enough. People haven't done that, unfortunately. So since it's most likely going to close, this show we're going to talk to the radio audience about podcasting and kind of introduce how podcasting works. And since you're a podcast listener, you probably already know all that. So sorry about that. Also, the show is going to be a little shorter this week because they need some pitch spots that won't be in the podcast. But if you'd like to contribute to KOSP, if you want to make it happen, make it work, and you know the station really well and feel like you'd like to do that, please feel free to donate at KOSP.org. Should we get on with the show?
Yep.
This is Geek Speak, episode 17 of our 16th season. You're listening to Independent Public Radio 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz and streaming live worldwide at KOSP.org. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP or any of the geeks affiliated organizations. I'm Lyle Troxell, your host and producer of Geek Speak, and with me in the studio is Mr. Miles Elam. He's a software engineer and political junkie. Hey, Miles.
How's it going?
Pretty good. Pretty good. Good to see you again. Thanks for making it out here. Yep. I appreciate it. If you'd like to participate in the comments about the show, you're welcome to send us email, geeks@geekspeak.org. I think I read all the messages. I don't always reply. What about you? Do you read most of the email?
I try to get sidetracked on other things.
Yeah. Yeah. But feel free to do so, and hopefully we'll catch it and respond. Hey, talk to us about drones.
Well, we talked in the past about how drones in an area where there was a fire being fought meant that all the aircraft had to clear the airspace, and it would cause problems and all sorts of logistical snafus, and how irresponsible the drone owners were for going, hey, I want to check out this firefight, and
sure.
You're actually making things worse. Now drones are being used to help fight the fires.
I would assume they're not actually carrying water or anything. Probably recon?
They're doing recon. They're also they're testing out to see if they can help with
fighting,
like to yeah. actually, you know, take some small amounts or to – but mostly, yeah, it is just, you know, pointing out where the hotspots are. And
it makes a lot of sense. I mean, I'm assuming that a lot of times the firefighting planes are also giving data back to the firefighters, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, having a lot of them in flight and also where you need them is challenging. But if you have ground crew that can launch a drone, you know, a few thousand feet above where they are, I'm sure that can tell them a lot.
Yeah. Although I would imagine that also a drone could be responsible for starting a controlled burn. So if you were doing a fire break.
Yeah. Tell me about controlled burns.
Well, you have a couple of things. One is you do a control burn in an area just to reduce the amount of undergrowth so that when there is a fire in the area, it isn't so combustible. It doesn't have so much fuel to work with.
An obvious example of this is you have, let's say, a field, and the field is abutted to a road, and also the other side of the field is wild forest, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you don't want to damage the wild forest, but at the same time, somebody could pull over their car, light the grasses on fire, and that fire, with no one's there, could spread and burn down the whole forest.
Mm-hmm.
So instead, once every 3 years or so, you start a fire in the field, but you have a lot of people there, make sure it doesn't spread.
Well, not just that for the field, but within the forest itself, because you try to control it so that it gets just the undergrowth.
Hmm.
So that you get rid of a lot of the detritus that would be fuel for a later major fire.
Yeah.
A lot of forests are more healthy when you do those types of controlled burns, and as opposed to putting them out before. If you always put out the fire before it goes anywhere, then all of that vegetation just keeps building up and building up and building up, so that when you do have a fire and it starts taking over, it goes very fast, very hot,
sure,
and does a lot more damage.
I didn't know they did control burns in actual forest. I thought it was normally –
they do.
That's cool.
You also do control burns for making fire breaks.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a forest fire going on and the fire is heading toward a particular area. So you do a controlled burn in an area to take away the fuel that the main forest fire would have used.
Right. In fact, there's a great way to get out of a fire by you're in a field. The fire is coming towards you. You run up to the fire. You grab some of it. You run back quite a bit. Start a line and it burns. And as that spreads and burns, you kind of walk around that line. So you're behind it where it has already burned and you're safe effectively. That's kind of cool.
Assuming you still have oxygen to breathe.
Because that can happen. You can not have enough oxygen to breathe?
Yes.
Wow. I don't want to be dead in the fire.
Then again, if the fire is that bad, you also have that whole heat issue.
So you're suggesting that they might be able to use drones to start controlled burns? So then you're talking about drones with flamethrowers or explosive bombs of some sort.
Or some flint, something like that to get things going.
You're not going to take a robot that can fly with a CPU and give it like a steel and flint. Come on.
Okay, sure. But at the same time, because if you know that there's a particular area that you want to get the fire break, but you need to get people there, especially if the fire's in your way, to fly over it and then have it do its thing.
It could be dangerous.
The worst thing that can happen is you lose your drone as opposed to trying to get materials out there to that spot as a choke point.
All right, cool. Well, thanks for that. Hey, we cover stories of battery improvement over the years. We've probably covered, I don't know, a million of these.
Batteries are going to get so much better, and then they get incrementally better.
I think early on I was really excited about any time of battery technology. Now I'm just going to become jaded.
Honestly, batteries have improved
so
tremendously.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I use nickel-cadmium batteries to work my RC car a while ago. And, I had a car that I would spend 15 minutes on a quick charge on the battery, and the battery would last maybe 5 minutes.
Right. Yeah, the charge time's definitely increased. Lithium ion is a much better battery. It's quite impressive.
Right. Nowadays, you can charge those little remote helicopters, and those remote helicopters go as long or longer than the charge time. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. So
what's new in batteries?
Yeah, so basically a battery, you've got an anode and a cathode of a battery, and you've got an electrolytic material in between, which means the electrons can freely go between the two, the cathode and the anode.
Because we always run over that part.
Yeah.
Some listeners may want to know a little bit more about that. So when we say cathode versus anode, what are we talking about there?
So you know how you have like a AA battery and it's got a little bump on one end and it's got a flat side on the other side?
Yeah, so the positive and the negative. The bump is the positive and the flat is the negative.
It's very convenient the bump is the positive. What actually occurs is inside the battery is a potential for a chemical reaction to occur. And the chemical reaction is moving ions from one side to the other. And basically you're moving I don't know which it works on normal batteries, whether it's a positive flow or a negative flow on the chemical reaction. Of course, I know which way the electrons are going, but you actually have to have a chemical reaction go between the two metallic pieces.
Right. Which way it goes, it depends upon which one has the electron deficit.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's a chemical reaction either way.
Well,
one side is a chemical reaction where it's losing electrons and one side is gaining electrons.
Well, so the positive side is always losing electrons, if you will, and the negative side is always gaining electrons. Or I guess that's the best way to describe it. It's hard to talk about flow and electricity, but I'm going to stop going into the depths of that because I feel like I'm going to have to get some paper out to really explain it well to myself, to even explain it to anybody else.
Right, but when we just say cathode versus anode, we're talking about the one side of the battery that has an excess of electrons and the other side that has a lack of electrons.
Right, and the anode is the positive side, so it has a...
You don't need to do that. You can just say the cathode and the anode are just the two ends of the battery.
The point that's going on here is that inside this material there's an acid bath, if you will, an electrolytic
For lead-acid batteries.
Yeah, but in general, electrolytic material that allows electrons to flow through it, or allows material to flow through it. So you have actual degradation of material from one anode of the cathode, and it deposits on the other. So there's actually a flow across. And every time it flows across, if you will, that's the movement of some amount of electrons.
Mm-hmm.
And the material can move either way, so that doesn't matter.
Yeah, which is great when it goes back and forth. The problem, if I may,
yes, please,
being that all you want is just the ions, you know, the electrons from one ion to flow to the others. But what happens in the real world is
chemical change. Yeah,
yeah. You start having chemical changes, two
molecules
components that you
move
don't
from
want,
one another. Yeah,
yeah. That you don't want to combine will combine.
Right. So what occurs is that the actual material moves through this chemical reaction. It moves from one side to the other side. And as it does that, it becomes less and less potential energy, and the battery runs out of juice. You can cause the battery to do the opposite reaction by putting power in the opposite direction. And then that chemical reaction will actually happen in reverse. Some things are better at doing that aspect than the other. We call the ones that are good at doing it rechargeable batteries. We call the ones that aren't good at doing it non-rechargeable batteries. Both of them actually do it. You can actually recharge a non-rechargeable battery. It's
but
just really inefficient.
But please don't put an alkaline battery, you know, or a lead acid battery into a
charger
for a lithium
NiCad
battery.
One of the problems with this reaction is that it's not a perfect sum in some game. It's going to actually output, as all reactions do, output some kind of heat, some kind of energy waste. And that energy waste is heat, and therefore it can catch on fire. It doesn't necessarily catch on fire, but it can burst.
Or just gain increase the pressure due to heat,
right.
And then you have
and then
it bursting.
And burst, and then, as I said, this material sometimes is acid, so not such a good thing to get on you. Lithium ion does a really good job. The reason we like it so much is it does a good job of keeping a charge and also of recycling that charge. So after you do that charge, when you have that, use the energy up, the chemical reaction deposits on the side. And when you reverse charge it, the chemical reaction reverses. But over time, that degrades. Every time you cycle the battery, it does that a little bit less and a little bit less and a little bit less, because you can kind of imagine the crusty material being on there not perfectly doing its job because the world is dirty. Mm-hmm. Is that a good way of saying?
Mm-hmm.
So battery cycles is a big reason why lithium ion batteries over time degrade. You had a Prius, right? Prius, right? So your Prius, when you first bought it, you knew that your battery pack might only last a certain amount of time.
Actually, the battery pack would have lasted okay if I hadn't abused that car quite so much.
But you did have to replace the battery pack, right?
I did, but there are a lot of folks who have Priuses that have gone for 200,000 miles and don't have the battery replaced.
Right.
So it goes back and forth. The idea behind the Prius was taking advantage of the nickel metal hydride batteries that they had, which was, as long as you don't make them too charged for too long or too low a charge for too long, if you keep them in that sweet spot in the middle, they last a really long time.
Yeah. So researchers at Irvine have come up with – and this is the amazing thing about this is they kind of discovered this accidentally.
No, kind of. They totally
– well, yeah. I mean, the thing is, they're researching battery technology. So it's not like they were like making toothpicks and were like, oh my god, a good battery.
All right.
You know, they were in that space. What was happening is UC Irvine group has used gold nanowires. So – and we're talking about nano. We're talking about bacterial
atomic scale
size.
Yeah.
Bacterial size is a good way to think about it, right? So they're really, really small gold wires. And then they actually – coated this gold wire, put this gold wire in a bath, a electrolytic gel. And they've tried to do this quite a bit in the past, and it has, you know, it sometimes is effective and sometimes it isn't. But in this situation, this gel actually, along with a coating that was on the wire, and I'm blanking on the type of coating it was, a metal oxide coating that was on the gold nano wire, together with electrolyte, has caused a kind of a flexible membrane to exist protecting the wire. And what this means is that instead of the normal degradation you see with lithium in this form, they don't normally use wires in lithium, they use sheets because of the degradation.
Mm-hmm.
But in this situation, they had 200,000 charge cycles with almost no loss. Which is
5% loss, yeah.
5% loss, yeah, which is really good compared to lithium ion. And so this has basically another field of research on how we could make successful batteries using other types of technology. And of course, lithium's not the best choice because it does happen to be very volatile. And so lithium in water, for example, burns and they can
lithium
catch on fire.
Exposed to air.
Yeah, basically corrodes immediately. So it's not the best thing. So the gel does more than just hold the wire together. They actually held the wire together. It also seems to make a metal oxide softener, and it makes it fracture resistant. And this increases the fracture toughness of the metal. The thing that's really cool, and therefore increases the charge capability of, and recharge capability, the thing that's really neat about this is they don't exactly know why it's doing what it's doing.
Yeah.
And this is the neat space of really small materials, is that it's in that realm that gets close to quantum physics, and so you start not – your intuition is not what you need. You need science points and then lots of math. Congratulations to Irvine, and I'm hoping that we'll see – output of this at some time.
Yeah, and someone might ask, why were they using gold? Did they just run out of elements? Well, it turns out gold is a great is a reasonably good conductor.
Yes.
But it's also, for all intents and purposes, non-corrosive.
Corrosive, right. It doesn't corrode, yeah. In fact, you know what's better at – as base metals, you know what's better at conducting electricity than gold?
Silver.
Yes, that's right. That's very good.
You know what's better than silver? Copper?
No, copper is not as good as silver.
Really?
No, I think silver. Silver wins, then copper, then gold. But
I thought copper was better, but silver wasn't. No,
silver corrodes badly.
Because copper corrodes.
Should we do a Wikipedia look up?
Yeah, we should.
All right, we'll do that. Right.
Wikipedia challenge.
Silver. Let's see. Silver or copper? Conductivity. Yeah, silver or copper conductivity. So much fun. Electrical resistance and yeah
fun for us. I'm wondering how the audience is feeling about this right now.
Well, you know, it's funny. That's how we actually do the show, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, off the seat of our pants, you mean?
I think so. I'm actually having trouble finding it. this is all about, like, specific. I just want a chart, man. Did you find it? All right, you know what? I'm gonna have to start editing the podcast right here, I gotta say. All right, metal conductivity materials chart. The best electrical conductivity
is silver.
Silver, then copper, and then gold. Hey, I was right, and you were wrong.
You were right by 5%.
And look, aluminum is actually right after gold. So the problems with using silver, the reason we don't use silver very often, is that it corrodes too easily. Mm-hmm. That's why you have to polish silver all the time.
Right.
Right? Copper doesn't corrode as badly, but it also corrodes. Gold doesn't corrode.
But it's 30 to 35% less conductive.
Right. So it's very common for high-end equipment to have copper wire with gold tips.
Actually, when I was making radio control cars, there were many connectors that were gold-plated because you're running these buggies out in the middle of mud and stuff like that. So you want something that's non-corrosive.
Absolutely.
But still highly conductive.
And that's exactly why it's what it's good for. The corrosion just doesn't happen. And of course, if you've ever opened, like, a piece of electronics and the battery has, like, nasty white stuff all over it.
The car battery, you mean?
Yeah, I guess a normal battery. That's because the battery's actually failed and the electrolyte has come out into the environment and caused that to totally fail. You want to clean that off. Don't want to get on your hands necessarily and make it all clean.
Wash your hands afterwards.
Yeah. But it is very common for an electrical problem to be the connectors. So you can have, like, a bad wash machine or something like that, and you take it apart and plug it all back together and it works again because copper corrodes. And so you can get spray-on material that will actually help the corrosion be reduced. And
that's like Coca-Cola.
Like Coca-Cola does that?
Yeah.
That's seriously?
You put it onto the terminals on your car battery and that will clean them off.
It would clean them off, but then you also want to put something that would protect
it. Oh, right, to seal. Yeah.
And so sometimes you'll have a car battery that has a red goop on it. That's what that is. It's just a material that causes a barrier from the air so that the doesn't corrode. Have we gone into that enough now?
Oh, yeah.
We're good, right?
All yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Whew. What's going on with CERN?
CERN, those folks that had the Large Hadron Collider that have been working with the so-called Goddard particle, the Higgs boson.
That's the name of my dog.
Yeah, that do ever larger amounts of energies to find all these weird and exotic materials that blink into existence for so small a period of time you hardly wonder if they ever existed in the first place. Well, they're releasing their data, open access. So 300 terabytes of data. So if you're going, what do those CERN guys know? I bet I could find where the Higgs boson was. Then by all means.
300 terabytes of data.
Yep.
Let me whip out my USB drive. Oh, it's not big enough. How do you even get a copy of that?
You get an array of hard drives and you Well, you know,
you bring it
download
to them
for a really long time.
No, I think you go visit them with that kind of hard drive need. So this means
I was
that,
thinking, like, yeah, you'd hit the Comcast cap. Yeah, you hit it every single month for the next two or three years, and then you'll have it downloaded.
It would take forever to download that. That's not even – that's something you can actually transfer on the internet very easily. 300 terabytes?
Okay.
Anyway, I guess that's kind of amazing about these newfangled devices. It's not like there's a photovoltaic a paper that is sensitive to light and picks up this stuff, and you have like negatives. You have raw data. Like – all mm-hmm. these signs, all these experiments are just sensors that put into, you know, that do an analog to digital immediately, mm-hmm. and you get digital data. So all of the experiments they've been running are captured, I'm assuming, and now they're just spreading the love.
Yep.
Do you think people will be able to find other stuff they weren't looking for in this data? Or is it more like, here's our garbage. We're done with this. You can have it.
No, I think there will be some useful stuff that people can glean from it. Mm-hmm. I don't think that it will be you or I. I think it will be, some folks at Caltech or MIT or whatever that go through and try to find certain patterns that CERN wasn't looking for, but they want to correlate because they don't have a super collider on the same scale. You know,
right.
Not all their students would have it, and you want grad students to be able to have access to these types of experiments and see what they can do with it. So,
cool. Hey, I'm Lyle Troxell. You're listening to GeekSpeak on Independent Public Radio KOSP. I'm talking with Miles Elam. In a minute, we're going to talk about podcasting. How do you do it? What do you use? How does it work? And all that loveliness about podcasting. So if you feel like you've been behind the times and you don't exactly know what a podcast is or how to get it working or should you or whatever, stay tuned. We'll tell you all about it. This is GeekSpeak. Hey, if you have comments or questions and all that, you can contact us at geeks@geekspeak.org. And of course, all the things we talk about are up at geekspeak.org. When Miles and I actually took over the show 15 years ago?
16.
Okay, 16 years ago.
Almost 16.
When we first took over the show, it was like 16 years ago. The show had already been going on, and the wonderful people that had run the show had already bought the domain geekspeak.org. And so they just handed it over to me, and we've been maintaining it since then, probably edited multiple website versions of it over the years.
Mm-hmm.
At first, it was just straight HTML, and then it became an XML, XSLT thing that Miles and I – well, Miles produced, but there was no editor, so you had to edit XML for years. I hate XML because of the website. Until I finally wrote an app that actually – a couple of versions of the app. In any case, I say all this because we actually quite committed to the internet side of things, as the show includes a lot of content about
a tech
internets.
Show committed to the tech side of things. It's really
incredible.
Odd.
Yeah. And we're both pretty geeky people, obviously, with the show. And one of the at one point, Real Simple Syndication, RSS, a way to share documents also through XML, oddly enough, was enhanced to support the idea of an enclosure or an audio file. And hence, podcasting was born. And so when that occurred, we went, you know, about a month into the podcasting really being aware of it, I was like, oh, I should just make this show a podcast. And so I hand-edited an XML document to create the first version of our podcast. Now, we actually were pretty early on the scene in podcasting, as you can imagine. I'm not actually sure when I turned it on. I'll have to look at the Internet Archive's Wayback Machine to find out when we actually went online. Maybe we should do that right now. In any case, since then, it's been possible to subscribe to the podcast of GeekSpeak and listen to it that way. And so we have a myriad of people listening via podcast and people listening via radio, of course. And so Miles and I are, I guess for years now, I really think about it. When I talk to people outside of Santa Cruz, when I travel and stuff, I go, oh, I've got a podcast. I tell them, yeah, it's a radio show too. But of course, you're outside of the area. You don't know it's a radio show. You just know it's a podcast. And I think we have about the same amount of podcast listeners as radio listeners. So we're about 50-50. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the radio people, though, don't know anything about podcasts. So I figure we'd talk about podcasts and really annoy the podcast listeners on the show. the first thing I want to say about podcasting that's kind of exciting is, even though people found out about it because of Apple's iTunes and their library system in iTunes, where you can actually find podcasts and subscribe to them. And it was it's called a podcast because at the time the iPod was the phenomenon. This is before mm-hmm. the iPhone. And the iPod and ability to get something that was all automatically delivered to you that's where podcasting term came from. And so Apple kind of made it pop culture that podcasting exists. But in no way does Apple actually control podcasting. And that's the neat thing about podcasting is it is a distributed form of entertainment. Does that make sense?
Yes, fairly distributed. There are still some choke points,
yeah,
unfortunately. Like, for example, I would love if our podcasts in general, especially on iTunes, supported torrents.
Right. The protocols and stuff haven't grown very much. It's all through HTTP.
And almost exclusively MP3s.
Yeah.
Although if you're on iTunes, some people will just say like, oh, I'm always on iTunes, so I'll just do AAC.
Right. So the audio file, what the reason I say it's distributed is it's not like your posts on Facebook. When you do a post on Facebook, you are adding to the Facebook empire, right? All the content's inside there. It's a walled garden. You have to have an account to get access to it, to post on it, to participate. You have to actually abide by their rules because it's their baby. It's their garden. And podcasting is not like that. Podcasting is just like an individual website. So you go to geekspeak.org and there's one path at geekspeak.org, which is a file, and that file talks about the last 10 shows. I only have 10 up there because it's actually kind of expensive for us if people grab the 300 episodes or I don't know how many episodes we have up there, a lot. Yes. It's too expensive to have people scrape those. So I just published the last 10 of them. If you want access to the old ones, please let us know because, of course, we can make a torrent for you.
Yeah, that's the thing. If iTunes and other popular clients supported torrent, we'd put all of them up there.
Sure.
Because it wouldn't matter. It's a peer-to-peer file sharing. So the more people want it, the faster it gets downloaded because they're all sharing it together as opposed to just coming from a single point.
In fact, we do have all the shows up in audio form as MP3 files and some other file formats we were playing with for a while, like Ogg Vorbis for some shows. They're up and you can go to the show page and you can click on the link and download the MP3 directly. But if you want to listen to audio, going to a website and searching it and then clicking on a link and then downloading an MP3 file and uploading it to your phone or having it just kind of ethereal on your phone because you started on your phone is not the best experience because, of course, if you close it and want to go back to it, it doesn't keep the position of where you were. Like if you read a book and always had to start at the beginning, it would be kind of annoying.
Mm-hmm.
So having the capabilities of a player that keeps track of things like that, where you were playing, what shows you actually like and are subscribing to, which ones you've played, which ones are new, that is a podcast application. That's what those are called. And you kind of want to use one when you're consuming content like this because it's not like the radio where you just turn it on and it starts feeding you. You really have to go and ask for what you want.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a couple years ago, there was a big explosion of pop culture podcasting, so such that most people know what it is and most people – and a lot of people use it. And Serial, the offshoot from the people that do – This American Life, some of those people created the podcast called Serial, and it was about a criminal case. And it became extremely popular. I know this because a lot of people talked to me about podcasting after that. So in any case, you need a podcast app to actually subscribe. That's what we call it, subscribing to a podcast. And the one, if you have a Macintosh, the one you can use is just iTunes. iTunes, you open it up, and one of the tabs in there, if you search around for podcasts, you'll find it. If you search for GeekSpeak, I don't think GeekSpeak is actually the first one on the list. If you search for me, Lyle Troxell, on iTunes, you'll find it right away. I think you have to say KOSP Geeks or GeekSpeak KOSP, something like that to get it. And Miles is searching iTunes right
yeah,
now.
Just...
Anyway. So you find the show, and there's lots of great shows up there. In fact, the amount of content out there, I urge people not to listen to stuff they don't like because there is so much wonderful content in this era. Of course, you know, I work for Netflix. So of course, I feel that way. You should watch stuff you enjoy.
We are number one when you search for GeekSpeak.
As one word?
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. Okay. Search for GeekSpeak, one word on iTunes, and you'll find us. And what's cool about this is you can review, and I'd love if people reviewed us. It just helps spread the word. If you like the show. If you don't like the show, don't review us. And you can download old versions, up to 10 episodes of them. And you can also, you know, you can write something about it. But additionally, like at the bottom of our page, there's other podcasts that you might like if you like GeekSpeak, which is an amazingly cool way to find more content. I listen to probably about 6 podcasts a week, I would say, depending on my commute and such, if I'm not listening to music. What about you, Miles?
I'm haphazard. The podcasts that I listen to tend to be longer format, and I just don't have enough time to dedicate to all of them. But I do spend time, like I've mentioned before, Dan Carlin's Hardcore History.
Mm-hmm.
But I also listen to Forum, KQED's Forum on podcasts, things like that. But they are such a long period of time. I don't have them going in the background because it's not like music.
No,
where you just have it in the background. It's just feel good. You have to be paying attention.
Yeah.
or at least the shows that I like the most are the ones that are intellectually stimulating, and those are the types you have to pay attention to, is not just random jokes coming through.
Right. So if you're on a – if you have a smartphone as your primary – like as a device in your life, or a tablet, these actually, of course, support apps, and there are some great apps out there for subscribing to podcasts. I prefer that rather than my laptop, because if I have it on my laptop, I'm going to be – you know, have to be on my laptop to actually mm-hmm. listen to the podcast. It doesn't work real well. So for Android, I'm actually putting a couple links on the GeekSpeak website so that you guys can see this. If you go up to our site, you'll see it's the April 30th episode of GeekSpeak. That's the one we tag. It's also episode 17. In any case, there's a link for Android apps, and I just did a Google search, best Android podcasting apps, mm-hmm. and there's a big list of them. Some of them are free. Beyond Pod is one I used to use when I had an Android device. And basically, when you install that and launch it, you can then say find podcasts, and when you go and search in there, you'll still find the shows you want. And as you subscribe to a few, you'll get recommendations for others. On iOS, I've spoken about this podcast app a lot. I like it quite a bit. It's called Overcast, and overcast.fm is the domain name. But on iTunes, it's an app store for iOS. It's a very popular app, Overcast. One of the features I like about it is it's got two kind of built-in smart speed and voice boost. Voice boost is basically a good compression algorithm, an audio compression algorithm, because not everybody that produces podcasts really knows what they're doing. And because of that, you'll get some inconsistency in quality shows with really wonderful content, mm-hmm. which I think is charming, but kind of annoying to listen to. And so you click this smart boost or voice boost, and it basically cleans up the audio for you, makes it louder, makes it consistent. And then the smart speed will take out the long breaks. Sorry, I can't keep that up. So those two things are cool.
Yeah, that's really annoying on radio.
It is, isn't it? Well, if you're listening to this via Overcast, you probably won't even hear that break.
Yeah, and if you're listening by a podcast, I'm sure a lot of listeners are listening at double the speed, so we are actually speaking faster than we normally do, which I'm sure is horrifying quite a few of you out there.
I pretty regularly listen to talk show podcasts in double or triple time on Overcast. It's one of the features that it supports really well. And it doesn't do pitch manipulation, so it doesn't sound like everybody's a mouse. It's just really fast. But I have to say that I was listening to recently a show, and the talk show covered a whole bunch of stuff about Prince, because of course Prince just passed away. And so they kept on cutting to music segments. It was short music segments, but it was wrong. The speed was all off, and it was causing me a headache, so I had to slow down the podcast to normal speed.
Did everyone cause you any pain?
good reference. So in any case, I don't know. I already talk pretty fast. I'm sure people listen to the show multi-speed though, right?
Mm-hmm. If we talk too fast for you, you can go onto a podcast and listen at half speed.
That's true.
And we start talking like normal human beings.
No one wants to listen to that. It takes twice as long to get through it. Any case, so I want to – if you have never done podcast, I want to urge you to do this. It's the contemporary state of media in a lot of ways. I want podcasting to remain independent. There are some services out there that have become kind of promoting their own walled garden. A perfect example is NPR has this app called the NPR One app. And I just heard an ad on one of their NPR podcasts. And it's so frustrating because, of course, NPR produces their content and then subsidize it through independent radio stations. And the rules on rebroadcasting independent radio is you cannot have commercial content on there. You can't say this is the best thing ever. You have to have truthful information. You can't have claims. And that's what sounds so different about KUSP, for example. And then you listen to the podcast version of the NPR show, and they are putting ads in it. And it's like, that seems so counterintuitive because there's no FCC regulations against it, right? Mm-hmm. And it's very effective to put ads in things. So one of the ads they're putting in was for their own app, saying this is an amazing way to get content. And I agree the NPR One app is executed perfectly, like really well. I know one of the former developers on it who works with me at Netflix. And I think the app is great, but they're promoting features that are not podcast friendly. They're not open. They're closed garden. So they release content on that system before they release it on the podcast. The idea being that you'll get hooked to their app and you'll never leave their environment. Would it like getting hooked on NBC or HBO content or whatever, or paying for Netflix? And kind of, you only have what they have, and that's the world that you live in, existing Facebook. Yeah. What are your thoughts on some of this, Miles? I'm talking
about. Well, it's much the same as an annoyance that I have. It's just a little bit off the beaten trail. But whenever I'm looking on my Chromecast, for example, and looking for content, you have to know the app that you want to go to be able to look at it. But then you say, is that movie on Netflix or is it on Amazon Prime or is it on HBO Go or is it on Showtime?
Yeah. Right, right.
And that's something that I really liked about Roku.
Yeah.
Just a quick plug was because
Roku is like a Chromecast app, a piece of hardware.
Yeah. I would search for something and it would tell you it's available at this location, this location, this location, this location. You go, okay, I want to watch this one on HBO.
Versus the new Netflix. Apple TV also has that feature of being able to search across multiple services,
which is great. But you go to something else. Like I have an Amazon Fire Stick at home as well. I have all of the devices. And it's just annoying to be able to, okay, I'm going to go search for something. Oh, it's showing me if it's on Amazon.
Right.
It still supports Netflix, but
they're pushing their own content, of course, because they make more money that way.
Right. Yeah, but I can't get Google content on Amazon. And then Chromecast, I can't get Amazon content.
So all the content distribution products you're talking about, they are not supporting RSS. They're not an open standard. They're their own infrastructure. In fact, you know, at Netflix, I work at Netflix, and we protect what's in our catalog. We don't make that completely open. We don't allow you to search it. You can. People do have the features to do that. They kind of hack the system. But we don't do that just directly because that's not our primary goal as a provider of content, right? Mm-hmm. And Amazon's the same way. All of these companies have their own purpose in mind, which is fine. I'm not going to say no to that. I like a lot of these services. I like having my job, for example. But I have to say that that hasn't happened in the podcasting space. In the podcasting space right now, the primary way of getting audio content is through podcasts with individual distributors or small networks of distributors that control their own distribution. Mm-hmm. And that is really cool. And I don't want that to lose. I like that capability. So I want people to be informed a bit about it. Unfortunately, it's always been slightly technical. And therefore, you have the onus is kind of on the individual to kind of understand how to do it. So I urge you to take your podcast, your phone, your smartphone, add a podcasting application, subscribe to a couple shows, and listen to it for a while and try it out. You will find content that's right up your alley. If you are really into putting sweaters on turtles, which is silly, of course, because it's a reptile and they're cold-blooded, you will find a podcast about how to design sweaters for turtles. I mean, the content depth is amazing in this self-production world. So I urge you to take a few minutes during this week, figure out how to get your life podcast capable, and enrich yourselves with extra wonderful content. This is Gee Speak on KOSP. I'm Lyle Troxell. Miles and I are going to cover some more news in just a minute, including, what else are we going to talk about? How about spying? Spying. All right. It may be a big merger of a corporation. We'll be right back. It's Geek Speak on 88.9 KOSP and KOSP.org. I'm Lyle Troxell. I'm speaking with Mr. Miles Elam. Miles, earlier we were covering cathodes and anodes, and I could tell that there were chemists and battery experts in our listening audience that would go and be really frustrated with our response. The wonderful thing about this podcast and radio show is that we would love to get that feedback, and I will definitely read a correction to really clarify that problem for myself, for you, and for everyone listening next week.
Because when we read the Wikipedia article just to bone up on it, we were like, yeah, okay, there's no way to cover this.
Really, do a whole show on anodes and cathodes. What's going on with that big conglomerates? This is kind of a sad story for me. I don't like it.
Really?
Yeah. But good things happen, so go on.
The Justice Department is giving approval to Charter Communications to merge with or to purchase Time Warner Cable and Bright House Networks. And this is – otherwise it would be subject to antitrust, or rather it is subject to antitrust. That's why they have to go through the
– That's right.
The hoops here. And this is more consolidation of media, like fewer and fewer people owning the means to get media to and fro, get information to and fro. Oftentimes they're the internet provider as well.
There was a while ago we kind of talked and covered a story about Time Warner and Comcast merging. That would have made Comcast even bigger. They're already the biggest cable provider. So now Charter –
and number one and number two are going to merge.
Kind of scary. So now Charter consuming with Time Warner is in some ways – not as bad.
Yeah. It's still creating the second largest. They're still behind Comcast combined. At the same time, they put a few conditions on it.
That's a good thing.
They were saying that they are not allowed to tell their content providers, you know, their HBOs, their AMCs, stuff like that, that they They're not allowed to tell them they cannot put a streaming version of their app onto their service.
Okay. So it could be that of course, this is a cable company, but they're also internet companies. They're kind of one and the same mm-hmm. in a lot of ways. And so this merger says you can do this merger, but you can't stop like an HBO from being on your internet providing space and not just your cable TV space.
Right. Or servicing the same area with that the streaming product. Yeah. So there's that. And that's actually a pretty big deal. That is something that's good, especially because you have the things like HBO Go showing up. And before you didn't have any streaming services. And with Comcast, I actually had to wait a while before I could get HBO on there because they just didn't make the deal. It wasn't because they didn't have the infrastructure.
Right.
It was because Comcast wanted the payoff.
And yeah. I mean, the department mandates impose these mandates on the merger. They're saying, yes, you can do this as long as you do these things. The two basic areas is to protect streaming video companies and to provide a cheaper broadband service to low-income families. Both these are they put in structure mandates for that purpose. Now, whether those will actually be successful or not is interesting. I think it's neat the phrasing of this article by Reuters. Thank you. I knew I was reading it wrong. Says protecting streaming video companies. I don't think that it's necessarily protecting as serving – like putting a base – I mean, is it protecting? I guess it's protecting.
Yeah, it is. It is tipping the scales a bit more in their favor or more tipping the scales so they're not so completely out of their favor.
Yeah, it's basically ensuring competition exists, mm-hmm. right? Because if the ISPs, the large form ISPs, actually put in mandates like, sure, pay us back, things of that nature, mm-hmm. it becomes a less friendly environment. It's already a pretty poor environment for fledgling companies, mm-hmm. you know, for the next YouTube or the Netflix service that doesn't exist yet. It's still not a very easy market to enter.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, MSNBC, Fox, HBO, Showtime, all of those are independent companies, independent providers and producers of content. And when you have a provider like Comcast or Time Warner or Charter saying you're not allowed to have a streaming product at the same time because it would conflict with our model, that's telling another business you can't work to in your own best interest. You have to work in our best interest. And that's the back and forth there, to be able to say that the cable company can't tell a company you can't work in your own best interest to try to get your product out as far as possible,
right.
Especially because we are a de facto monopoly, you know, in all the areas.
So, so in the last few years, we've actually seen a shift from a business controlled by hundreds of little regional outfits to controlled by like three major players: mm-hmm. Comcast, Charter, and Atlas, the European company, mm-hmm. That basically now I think owns Cablevision, which is the U.S. side that's mm-hmm. really large. And this
as far as like coax delivered content, yeah.
Yes, exactly, and network specifically. Like that's the big issue for me. I mean, traditional TV cable service, I know it's really important, but I want my data. From a geek's perspective, that's more important to me by far. But each one of these companies has you know, shapes their broadband and can control what's on their broadband at some level. And so anytime these mergers happen, it looks like the Trade Commission is producing more and more rules to say, we see that power and here are some limits on that power, which I think is a good balance to make. At the same time, I still feel like these things should be independent of corporations. Like I want network to be like water and electricity. Of course, water and electricity in the United States is pretty controlled by corporations anyway, so maybe I'm dreaming. I grew up in a commune, people.
Yeah, he's not kidding.
Let's talk about spying. You were talking about this guy that you absolutely hate earlier.
Yeah, the Clap. I mean, James Clapper.
Who is James Clapper?
James Clapper is the Director of National Intelligence. And he was saying recently this is according to the Christian Science Monitor, that because of Edward Snowden, it has sped up the sophistication of encryption by about 7 years.
Wait. So what you're saying is there is a certain level of sophistication throughout our systems and network, and that was always trending up to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
And if you predicted what would happen in 7 years, now that's where we are.
Yeah, 3 years ago they said in 10 years it's going to be at the certain level, and now only 3 years into it, that's that level they expected. And they were saying it's because of Snowden. And as you and I were remarking before the show, it's not because of Snowden. It's about what Snowden was talking about.
Yeah, what was the metaphor I had for that? Oh, no, I can't remember.
What yeah, I, what I don't remember. Example? Right, I rarely listen to you, actually.
Let's try to think of a metaphor really quick for this. It's akin to blaming the weatherman for a storm. No, that's not it.
Yeah, whatever.
The it's whole gone. Point it's is gone. Snowden actually didn't do anything about security. He showed what the truth was about how bad it was. And because of that, how bad it is, that's what caused it to increase quickly.
Right.
Yeah. I did better during dinner. Oh, well.
Oh, well.
So is that the full cover of the story? Why do you dislike the guy?
Well, from his point of view, and he says, from our standpoint, it's not a good thing. And he's very much in the camp of if we can't look at the traffic that's going by, then law enforcement can't do its job at all or very effectively. And there's been this whole big hype about the web going dark, like that, you know, communication going dark. Mm-hmm. That's the way they describe it, to say that once encryption goes along the wire from end to end, they can't and it's unbreakable or
they can't do their jobs anymore.
Right. They can't just eavesdrop.
Do you believe that's true? That it's better encryption actually degrades the police enforcement's ability to do things?
I think it's a nuanced conversation. Mm-hmm. I think that the genie is already out of the bottle.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of there's already really good encryption, but we want you to stop using it is just, you know, not going to happen. It's much the same terms as people use for guns. If you take away the guns from law-abiding, then the only criminals will have them.
Sure.
But even so, it's like this is U.S. laws, U.S. Guidelines. What happens for ISIS in Syria? Why would they not use encryption because of a U.S.
Right.
guideline? Like that doesn't – and, so if you're doing things like terrorism and you don't want to get caught.
So this chief spy guy is kind of – arguing from his side very loudly.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's kind of where you're like, oh, it doesn't feel nuanced, doesn't feel intellectual. It feels like scaremongering.
Well, especially because a former director of the CIA and the NSA
has come out saying – someone who had that same job before. Yeah.
Well, similar job anyway. Mm-hmm. Has come out saying that, no, actually, yes, there is a back and forth. And yes, if you're in that position, you want to push things as far as you can.
Sure.
As far as the law will let you, because if you do less and something bad happens, then not only are you to blame, but you let something happen.
Right.
But he was also saying there has to be some background. There has to be something that doesn't make the world just an East German Stasi, you know, dream
right.
for surveillance. Like this, is that really the society we want to live in?
Tell me about lab mice. Do you know anything about lab mice, Mal? Can you describe what a lab mouse looks like to you and what they're for? From off the top of your mind.
Lab mouse, usually a white mouse, or at least that's what I'm used to seeing. And they are commonly covered in tumors and stuff like that from the experiments that are being done on them.
Mm-hmm. Do we know why we use lab mice?
Because in terms of disease patterns, they are very similar to disease patterns within humans.
And a great way to think about this is that what you want for being able to produce to test things to see if diseases are more likely and safeties and all that is you want to have something that has a relatively short lifespan naturally so that you can reproduce them quickly so you can try to experiment over and over and over again.
And a high metabolism.
High metabolism, yeah. And you definitely want a mammal if you're going to be testing things that will be for humans because, of course, a mammal is going to be closer most likely to humans than non-mammals. So a mouse, it fits that pretty well. So we've had these reproduced mice that you can buy and labs buy these and keep on reproducing them. And they are basically a species unto themselves almost, in the sense mm-hmm. that they don't reproduce in the wild. It's not like they catch them in the wild. They grow them. They farm them. There's companies that do this and make sure they're healthy and all that stuff. And you get to order different lines of them.
Healthy until the researchers get their hands on them.
Right. Yeah. No. Normally it is, you know, causing disease. That's where you want the borderline. So these things are definitely treated pretty badly from a perspective of the mouse. For us, they're invaluable for research.
Right.
So in a study, two studies concluded and were published online on April 20th that mice bought from just like a normal pet store or caught in the wild actually have better efficacy of simulating immune systems in humans than those of lab mice. And the general process here is that, as I said, they're different kind of species in the sense that they've been isolated. Mm-hmm. It turns out if you take a store-bought mouse, you're going to get effects of that mouse that will match better what effect of human would be than one of these white lab mice.
That makes sense. I mean, think about turkeys. The butterball turkeys that you buy at the store for Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, folks, if you don't already know this. But they can't breed naturally. They weigh too much. They gain weight too quickly. So they're basically laying on the ground as you have to do artificial insemination to get them to reproduce.
Right.
Like so the assumptions you have about, well, let's look to see how birds procreate. You can't do that with, for example, Thanksgiving turkeys.
Hey, man, you listen to GeekSpeak, the more you know, right? Thank you, Miles, so much. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. Use our stuff any way you'd like. Just let them know the geek said hi. This is Independent Public Radio, 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz. Streaming live worldwide at kosp.org. To find out more of this episode or any episode of GeekSpeak, please visit us on geekspeak.org. Episode 17 of our 16th season, Firefighting Battery Podcast with Lab Mice. And thank you, Greg, for our title, and Chandler, for our intern. And thank you, Michael Newman of Pet Star Music, for our theme song. And thank you for listening. We'll see you next week. See you, Miles.
See ya. Of course, now we have the after show. So there was a bank that was hacked to siphon off nearly a billion dollars, covered on the show about a month ago.
We covered that story?
Yeah.
Okay.
And it was only uncovered because someone made a simple spelling error.
Beautiful.
And so when they went to go check on this, going like, what's up with this? And then they found out that this was a fraudulent set of transactions.
We didn't cover this story.
I'm pretty sure we did.
Why do you think that? Because I haven't missed a GeekSpeak in a long time. And I don't remember the story.
Okay. Well, maybe I missed it and I just gathered that news for that week.
Yeah, maybe.
Anyway, so there's more to this story.
I hope so. I don't even know the beginning. No, go ahead.
Which is one of the reasons why the hackers were able to get in the first place. Is because in the Swift Global Payment Network, they were using $10 switches to network the banks, the Bangladesh central banks together.
Wait, network switches.
Yeah.
$10 network switches.
Yeah. Netgear off the shelf. Yeah.
The price of the network switch does not denote its security necessarily.
Right. I mean, yes.
But they weren't managed, were they?
They were not managed. You are not going to get a managed managed switch for $10.
Right.
And they were oftentimes used secondhand, and they were not running firewall software. Which, if you're a bank,
that's wait. What do you mean they weren't running firewall software?
They weren't running firewall software.
Well, what were they doing? It's like it's ridiculous.
They had a connection to bank and to
it's
over
like
the
walking
network.
Around with your money outside of your body, stapled to you or something on the street,
or just Velcro to you, so that people could just rip it off easily. Yeah, pretty much.
That's amazing.
So, and just so you don't think it's just banks doing it, there was a configuration error in MongoDB.
MongoDB is a relatively famous or popular database server.
Yeah. Also known as NoSQL. Yeah.
Right.
Schemaless.
Do they have an SQL interface yet?
Yeah, who knows?
I bet they do.
I don't know. You just throw JSON at it. And
get JSON back?
Yeah. You throw JSON at it, and then you say where you want your indexes to be.
So MongoDB also had a security problem?
Well, no. MongoDB didn't have the problem. But the people running MongoDB – this is like the Bangladeshi. Like, they didn't really have a problem with the Swift network. They had a problem just you know, doing basic right. network security.
Sure.
Here, 93.4 million Mexican voters had their records hacked.
How many people?
93 million. 93.4 million. 132 gigabyte database containing personal information.
Yeesh.
It sat exposed to the public for 8 days after its discovery by the researcher. But it originally went public in September 2015.
Ooh, man.
So months.
Months of this data being completely public.
Yes. And that was a configuration error of, oh, this shouldn't be accessible from the public internet. Yeah. Rule number one. Your databases should not be accessible from the public internet.
Period.
Not directly.
Full stop.
Well, you get access to the data through some other
interface.
Through
an API.
Yeah. But you don't give access to the database itself.
Miles, can I just attack you for a second?
Sure.
You've been helping out with the restructuring GeekSpeak, coming up with some ideas about how we're going to do new stuff on the database side. Mm-hmm. Not the show, but the database side of things. And you've been talking about surfacing the database directly through a REST interface.
No. Well, through a REST interface, yeah, but that's still an API.
Yeah, but that's kind of a pretty big API. Where's the security model in that? Where's the, you know, I mean...
because we don't allow basically anything.
But you're going to allow updates.
Yes, the general public is going to have access to GET, and authenticated users have access to put and post and delete.
Okay. All right.
Which is how REST is.
I just think it's funny that before
handled.
The show we're talking about how you're like, yeah, there's a database, it'd be great to connect to the internet, it'd be great. During the show you're like, never connect your database to the internet.
Well, yes, do not connect PostgreSQL's port 5432.
Oh, now you've told everybody.
That's the same combination on my luggage. Don't connect that up directly to the internet for anyone to connect to, especially with, you know, like without any type of certificate authentication, definitely not over without any encryption going on.
All right, before we close out today, can you cover any space news?
Certainly. I can cover the fact that Dawn spacecraft.
What's that?
That's NASA's spacecraft that went to the Ceres asteroid.
Oh, yeah. I remember.
Or the largest object, the dwarf planet, large asteroid, schmang.
Mumble.
Yeah, so it found quite a few things about the Texas-sized dwarf planet, dotted with pretty brilliant white specks. Mm-hmm. What was impressive about this spacecraft was that it worked on an ion drive. Use xenon gas and use the charged ions to have them propel away from you. And then every action has an equal and opposite reaction, so you –
Ion drives last a long time with very little thrust, but a long time of little thrust actually works quite well.
Yeah, 0 to 60 in 4 weeks,
okay,
or something like that. But
so it's got a little bit of xenon left.
It got enough that they can go to another dwarf planet or
they can
to
actually
another
escape
asteroid.
The gravity well.
Well,
that's
dwarf
cool.
planets don't have that much gravity, and they were already pretty high up off of it. And they didn't want to. Just plow into the dwarf planet because – well, no. You do that for some experiments, but they hadn't –
because Don's like, no, I don't want to die.
No, because they hadn't cleaned off the spacecraft to sanitize it to make sure they weren't corrupting it with, you know, earthbound either microbes or
wisdom.
Particles or just materials that are
right.
coming from there.
So
if you want to find out –
they're actually going to – they're planning another flight for this thing. They're actually going to have to leave the main and go to another one?
Yep.
That is awesome.
Because they have enough fuel left over, which is unheard of with regard to
people
propellant.
People say we don't give NASA enough money. Propellant. They had extra fuel in that thing. Sorry, I couldn't resist.
Yeah, that's like telling teachers, like, yeah, but see, you were still able to go out and buy chalk with your own money.
We're obviously paying you too much.
Our budgets are obviously sufficient. Yeah. So that's
cool.
It's very much in the vein of the Mars Pathfinder and the stuff like that, where you had rovers that were meant to have 90-day lifespans going on for a decade, I think one of them went for, something like that. So, yeah, that's what's going on in space news that I came across that I thought was interesting.
All right, anything else you want to talk about yourself? No more looking at the computer. No?
What? That I want to talk about myself?
Yeah, anything else you want to talk about?
Yeah, I haven't talked about it much, but I am sad to see KOSP go. I guess I want to do a little epilogue here about KOSP. Not because GeekSpeak will stop because of it, because we're not. We're going to keep doing the podcast. Sure. We're still going to do the content. We enjoy doing it, and it's an excuse for us to hang out.
Mm-hmm. We're going to hang out. And we'll probably get to explore other things we don't normally do on air.
Right.
Maybe we'll start swearing. Probably not.
Probably not. But at the same time, I still think of KOSP as this wonderful incubator.
Yeah.
Like if it wasn't for KOSP, we would not be doing the show.
Oh, absolutely. No way.
Just – it wouldn't happen.
No.
Without KOSP, there wouldn't be things like the Agony Column, the Seventh Avenue Project.
Dr. Don's show.
Yeah. There are all these programs that are effectively going to stop if KOSP doesn't find an angel investor.
To be clear, I'm not sure all those might continue. We just listed. I don't know what their plans are. If KOSP can't come together with money. But you're right. The incubator aspect of it, this idea that there's this area, this location based on the idea that people can create audio and create stories and create music.
Gives you a ready-made audience.
Yeah, it's great.
Gives you a place to record the audio with the equipment and gives you, this routine to get into. Is invaluable.
Even though you're an imported alien into Santa Cruz, mm-hmm. I, grew up in Santa Cruz and am natural born. And I got to say that I find it a sad thing that Santa Cruz will lose that resource, right? Mm-hmm. That's to me the – because I understand that bandwidth on traditional radio broadcast is limited, and that frequency will be sold and go somewhere else and some other form will merge. And I don't know if it will serve the community that it served as well. It might turn into something that is not as healthy for sharing creativity, allowing people to create new content, incubating, but also just in general producing a voice for that area.
Yeah.
And KOSP's been doing it for over 44 years, something like that. Yeah. Long time to be there. And it is a shame that we are losing that if we do lose that.
Want to sell the frequency to assuming that some rich person isn't listening to our show and going, hey, you know what? I want to save KOSP. And it would be great. There's still time to do that.
It's a really good time to do that because at this point there's a plan forward that works pretty well. There's a little bit of debt that the KOSP has accumulated and has to get rid of that debt and move forward. We're talking about a year and a year and a half of difficulty but functional. After that point, probably really beautiful space.
And let's be honest. If you cough up $300,000, you have a lot of say about what you want your pet projects to be too.
I will. I don't know about that. That's the challenging part about a nonprofit that is managed by a board of volunteers.
Right.
There is this idea that the mission is better and more important than the individual. It's a difference between commercialism, right?
Right. But at the same time, KOSP goes away and has to sell the frequency. Who knows where it goes to? Will it go to one of those major media conglomerates eventually that
– Could.
Yeah, that no, we're that we definitely, complain about.
I run a small theater company building. Like I'm a board member for a building that's been a theater for a long time. In fact, my parents started the theater company. It's been a theater company for 35 years, 40 years, whatever. But reality, it's a public building that's used for servicing the community. And at one point, the theater organization, which I'm really close with, was like, hey, we want to kind of maybe have more relationship with the building and become it, make it really a theater and as the primary resource. I said, I love that it's mostly a theater right now. That's great. But in 30, 40, 50, 60 years, I do not know if the best way to serve the town of Ben Lomond will be a theater company there. It might be the best way to serve it is some completely new thing we don't even know about. So right now there's a trust for the building to serve the needs of the community. That's the mission. It doesn't matter what's happening right now. It matters that is capable for generations.
Right.
That's the feeling I have about KOSP. The reason it's sad is that it's
well, that
we're
grew
losing,
up, you grew up in KOSP.
Oh, totally. But we're losing that as a resource for the community. That's the part that's so difficult.
Yeah.
I mean, because the truth is I'm much easier to let go of little era problems and changes, right? We have a completely different station than we did have 2 years ago, right? It was mostly a talk station. I listened to it probably about the same amount as I listen to it now. Maybe I listen to the music shows more now. But that flux over time is what you have when you have control of your own thing. When you lose it, you don't know what's going to be. That's the loss, right? The ability for that change not to occur anymore.
Right.
Ability
and it's very easy for us to act the technocrat. Mm. And say, we have a podcast now, and people can just make a podcast now. You don't need the terrestrial radio like you did before. And
no, it's a loss.
It's a total loss. It's not like that. It's when you're talking about radio, you're also talking about localized geographic areas by necessity. Podcasts are great to get your message out all across the world, which we've done, but it doesn't perform the same function.
They don't knit a community together of location. They don't knit neighborhoods together, right?
Right.
And that is what something happens when you have a terrestrial-based thing, is you are a location as well as a community.
Yeah.
And that doesn't happen in these new forms.
It's like the hard thing with Facebook. It's like Facebook has that thing where it's global, and yet people try to have groups that end up being local, but then you have to make them close groups, or otherwise they get too diluted with people from outside, but then you're making it exclusive and it just gets all muddied together.
Yeah, and we don't have a good solution. I mean, it's don't get me wrong, I love the digital age where community is wherever you find it. Like, that's amazing. That's really cool. Mm. But community based on geography is something, it's important as a species. We are geographic beings, right? We it's important for us to be in an actual physical space and to live in a physical space, and to have media that represents the physical space is an important aspect, in my opinion, of how
media hear about what's going on, whether it be news-wise, whether it be music and cultural or stuff like that. Nearby you makes a difference, because yes, I could hear about something going on in Denmark, and it may be really cool, and I want to see the video on that and want to hear about that on a podcast, but it's not something that I can just hop out of the shower, go run down the street, and take part in.
Right.
That's the difference.
You didn't stay get dressed. Sorry.
Look, I'm not in college anymore.
Sir, please go back. All right. Since you didn't say anything like really private and embarrassing about you, Miles was naked man at UCSC for years.
No,
is that right?
I was not just the naked man. There were several naked people at UCSC. And in fact, every year there are people.
But I'm sorry, I didn't mean to derail what you're saying. Right. When it's local, you can participate in it at a completely different level.
Yeah.
Totally true.
And it becomes more visceral. It becomes more personal.
Yeah.
When something happens across the country, this whole thing, I mean, with federal politics, it shouldn't feel as personal as it does so often.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is so far away, and a lot of ways is so far removed from you as opposed to local politics. And yet, if you have a media conglomerate that is servicing a whole wide area, you don't have the information about your local politics.
Right. And also the people that are on there are not your neighbors, and they're not people around you.
I think of Gary Patton with the Land Use Report.
Like, it's a great program.
But it's about the Central Coast of California. It's about Santa Cruz, Monterey Bay, Monterey, Salinas Valley, those areas. And it just doesn't make sense as necessarily a global podcast. It may just have more appeal as a local one.
You can hear the way he's speaking on that program. That program is about speaking to the people in the area, right? And saying, look, it's time for you to step up and be a part of the community. I mean, I don't think I've ever gone to a land use meeting, but being aware of what's happening in that space has informed me in countless ways.
Well, things have come up on ballot measures that I've heard about on the land use report and then voted on it. Yeah,
exactly right. Yeah. Anyway, to all these people that have made 44 years of KOSP awesome, thank you. And I'm hoping that someone steps up at this point and helps make it happen.
And we're also realistic. And
We'll keep on doing speak. I hope that people will subscribe too. That would be great.
Yeah. And I hope many of the programs that were unique to KOSP continue on. Some of them will, some of them won't. Hopefully we'll stay, friends with many of them.
Certainly.
A lot of KOSP ended up being a bit of a family too. You'd end up seeing the same people over and over again for years, and you got to know what their interests were and who they were about. And
I'll definitely miss having that feeling of connection to the community. I mean, though, as much as it's fun to have a giant podcasting audience that is comparable to the size of the people that are in Santa Cruz area and Monterey, Central Coast, there's nothing like being in the Central Coast and seeing like a sticker on someone's car and like, they're feeding the meter and go, hey, I support KOSP too. Like that connection or being recognized at a store because of our voices, always an awesome feeling.
Well, on the bright side, I won't have to be hanging out with Lyle in a public place and someone go, hey, you're Lyle Troxell. And I'm standing right with him and I'm speaking and they're like, oh, hey, how you doing? Lyle.
I've even gone, and this is Miles. And they go, uh-huh. Oh,
you're one of the other guys. Okay. Yeah, so
you don't think that's just racism? It could be just straight racism.
Yeah, because people can really tell my race over a voice. I've had someone recognize my voice exactly once.
Seriously? Only once?
Yes.
I don't believe that. I don't think you talk – you don't speak in public, right? Because you have a very recognizable voice. I think the listeners of this program.
I went to an AT&T shop. I was getting phones for my parents, and one of the texts from the back was like, "Hey, you sound like that guy."
If you run into Miles in some environment and you recognize his voice, do not be quiet about it. You tell him, "Hey, I recognize your voice," and then say, "Lyle's a lot better voice than you." All right, Miles.
He has a lot better speaking voice. I have a much better singing voice.
Prove it.
Really?
Well, I'm gonna pot you out on the podcast, but go ahead and start.
Let it go. Let it go. Can't hold me back anymore. Let it go.